sex, and unlimited power. They were men who sowed corruption on the earth and plundered their peoples, men endowed with loud voices, a capacity for persuasion, for choosing sweet words and shooting poisoned arrows. Thus, the truth about them was revealed only after their deaths, and as a result, I discovered that history tended to repeat itself with a foolish obstinacy. Newspapers and magazines were delivered to the library regularly. I got into the habit of reading what was written in them and looking at the pictures, and so, quite often, I would stumble on the picture of one or other of these rulers as he sat with the congregation attending Friday morning prayers. There he sat, opening and closing his lids, looking out through them with an expression of great humility, like a man stricken to his depths. I could see he was trying to deceive Allah in the same way he deceived the people. Around him were gathered members of his retinue, nodding their heads in agreement and with admiration for everything that was being said, invoking Allah's blessings and his eternal majesty in subdued guttural tones, rubbing their hands one against the other, observing what went on around them with wary, doubting, stealthy eyes, ready to pounce, full of an aggressiveness that touched on the servile. I could see them as they prayed ardently for the souls of the nation's martyrs who had lost their lives as a result of war, famine, or pestilence. I would follow the heads going down and the buttocks coming up, fat, rounded buttocks swollen with flesh and fear. When they pronounced the word patriotism, I could tell at once that in their heart of hearts they feared not Allah, and that at the back of their minds, patriotism meant that the poor should die to defend the land of the rich, their land, for I knew that the poor had no land. When I became bored with reading history, which seemed unchanging, bored with the same old stories, the same pictures which all looked the same, I would go down to sit in the playground all alone. Often, the night would be dark, without a moon shedding its light from above. The last bell would have pealed out its last note a long while ago, leaving a deep silence behind. Around me, all the windows would be shut, and all the lights would be out, yet I would continue to sit in the dark alone and wonder about many things. What will become of me in the coming years? Will I go to university? Would my uncle agree to send me there for my studies? One night, a teacher saw me as I sat there. For a moment she was frightened by the sight of a mass that did not move, yet looked like a human shape sitting in the dark. Before coming near to me, she called out, "Who is sitting there?" In a weak, scared voice, I replied, "It's me, Ferdows." When she had drawn nearer, she recognized me and seemed surprised, for I was one of the best girls in her class, and the best girls used to go to bed as soon as the night bell rang. I told her I was feeling a little tense and had not been able to fall asleep, so she sat down next to me. Her name was Iqbal. She was short and plump, with long black hair and black eyes. I could see her eyes looking at me, observing me, despite the darkness. Every time I turned my head, they were after me, holding on to me, refusing to let me go. Even when I covered my face with both hands, they seemed to see through them into my eyes. Without warning, I burst into tears. The tears ran down my face behind my hands. She took hold of both my hands and lifted them away from my face. I heard her say, "Ferdows, Ferdows, please do not cry." "Let me cry," I said.
"I've never seen you cry before. What's happened to you?"
"Nothing, nothing at all."
"Impossible. Something must have happened."
"No, nothing has happened, Miss Iqbal." There was a note of surprise in her voice.
"Are you crying for no reason at all?"
"I do not know what the reason is. Nothing new has happened to me." She remained by my side, seated in silence. I could see her black eyes wandering into the night, and the tears welling up in them with a glistening light. She tightened her lips and swallowed hard, and suddenly the light in her eyes went out. Again and again they started to shine, and after a moment went out, like flames snuffed out in the night. But the moment came when she tightened her lips and swallowed hard, but in vain, for two tears stayed behind in her eyes. I saw them drop onto her nose and slowly trickle down each side. She hid her face with one hand, pulled out a handkerchief with the other and dabbed her nose. "Are you crying, Miss Iqbal?" I asked.
"No,"
she said, then hid her handkerchief, swallowed hard and smiled at me. The night around us was deep, silent, motionless, with not a single sound or movement anywhere. Everything was steeped in an absolute darkness through which no ray of light penetrated, for in the sky was neither moon nor sun. My face was turned towards her, and my eyes looked into her eyes, two rings of pure white surrounding two circles of intense black that looked out at me. As I continued to gaze into them, the white seemed to turn even whiter, and the black even blacker, as though light flowed through them from some unknown magical source which was neither on the earth nor in the heavens, for the earth was enveloped in the cloak of night, and the heavens had no sun nor moon to give them light. I held her eyes in mind, took her hand in mine. The feeling of our hands touching was strange, sudden. It was a feeling that made my body tremble with a deep, distant pleasure, more distant than the age of my remembered life, deeper than the consciousness I had carried with me throughout. I could feel it somewhere, like a part of my being which had been born with me when I was born, but had not grown with me when I had grown, like a part of my being that I had once known, but left behind when I was born. A cloudy awareness of something that could have been, and yet was never lived. At that moment a memory came to mind. My lips opened to speak, but my voice failed to come through, as though no sooner did I remember than I had already forgotten. My heart faltered, stifled by a frightened, frenzied beating over something precious I was on the point of losing, or had just lost, forever. My fingers held onto her hand with such violence that no force on earth, no matter how great, could tear it away from me. After that night, whenever we met, my lips parted to say something which no sooner remembered was already forgotten. My heart beat with fear, or with an emotion resembling fear. I wanted to reach out to her and take her hand, but she would enter the classroom and leave it after the lesson was over without seeming to have noticed my presence. When she happened to look at me, it was always in the same way as she looked at any of the other pupils. In bed, before going to sleep, I used to wonder, has Miss Iqbal forgotten? A moment later, Wafeya would draw her bed close to mine and ask,
"Forgotten what?"
"I don't know, Wafeya."
"You are living in a world of imagination, Fardos."
"Not at all, Wafeya. It did happen, you know."
"What happened?"
she inquired. I tried to explain to her what had happened, but I did not know how to describe it, or to be more precise, I found nothing to talk about. It was as if something had happened which I was unable to recall, or as if nothing had happened at all. I closed my eyes and tried to bring back the scene. Slowly there appeared two circles of intense black, surrounded by two rings of pure white. The more I stared into them, the bigger they grew, expanding before my eyes. The black circle kept growing until it reached the size of the earth, and the white circle expanded into a piercingly white mass, large as the sun. My eyes lost themselves in the black and the white until, blinded by their intensity, they could no longer perceive either one or the other. The image before my eyes became confused. I could no longer distinguish between the faces of my father and my mother, my uncle and Mohammedain, Iqbal and Wafeya. I opened my eyes wide in panic, as if threatened with blindness. I could see the outlines of Wafeya's face in front of me in the darkness. She was still awake, and I heard her say,
"Firdaus, are you in love with Miss Iqbal?"
"Me," I said with amazement.
"Yes, you. Who else, then?"
"Never, Wafeya."
"Then why do you talk about her every night?"
"Me talk about her? That's not true. You always exaggerate, Wafeya."
"Miss Iqbal is an excellent teacher," she commented.
"Yes," I agreed. "But she's a woman. How could I be in love with a woman?" There were only a few days left to the final examination. Wafeya no longer talked to me about her sweetheart, and the night bell no longer rang as early as before. Every night I would sit up late in the study room with Wafea and the other girls. Now and then the superintendent of the boarding house would walk in to inspect the way we studied, just as she used to walk around and inspect the way we slept or even dreamt. For if one of the girls so much as lifted her head to take a breath or rest her neck, she would appear suddenly out of nowhere, and the girl would immediately bend her head over the book again. I liked classes, and I enjoyed studying, despite the unfailing vigilance of the superintendent and other things. When the results of the final examination were announced, I was told that I had come out second in the school and seventh countrywide. On the night when the certificates were distributed, a special ceremony was held for the occasion. The principal called out my name in the big hall crowded with hundreds of mothers, fathers, and other relatives of the girls, but no one stepped up to take the certificate. A sudden silence descended on the hall. The principal called out my name a second time. I tried to stand up, but my legs failed me. I called out from my seat, "Present!" I saw all heads turned towards me and all eyes staring in my direction. Countless eyes transformed under my gaze into innumerable rings of white surrounding innumerable circles of black, which turned in a concerted circular movement to fix their look steadily in my eyes. The principal called out in a commanding voice,
"Don't reply while seated, stand up."
I realized that I was on my feet when the white rings and the black circles moved upwards in unison to fasten themselves once more on my eyes. The principal called out again in a loud voice that echoed in my ears, louder than any voice I had ever heard in my life before.
"Where is your guardian?"
A heavy silence descended on the hall, a silence which seemed to possess a resonance of its own. The air vibrated with a peculiar sound, and the breathing of many chests had a rhythmic tone which reached me at the back of the crowded hall. The heads swung back to their normal position, and there I stood, contemplating line upon line of backs sitting upright in their rows. Two eyes alone fastened themselves upon mine. No matter how far I shifted my gaze, or how much I moved my head, they followed me closely, tightened their hold. Everything was now enveloped in a growing darkness in which I could no longer discern the slightest glimmer of light, except for two jet-black eyes encircled by two rings of dazzling white. The more I gazed into them, the more intense the black and the white became, as though imbued with light from some magic source, for the hall was enveloped in total darkness, and the night outside was like liquid coal. It seemed to me as though I reached out in the dark and took her hand, or that she reached out in the dark and took my hand. The sudden contact made my body shiver with a pain so deep that it was almost like pleasure, or a pleasure so deep that it bordered on pain. It was a remote pleasure, buried in such faraway depths that it seemed to have arisen a very long time ago, longer than the length of memory, older than the remembered years of life's journey. Something no sooner remembered than forgotten, as if it had happened just once before, only to be lost for all time, or as though it had never happened at all. I parted my lips, ready to tell her all, but she said, "Don't say anything, Ferdus." She led me by my hand through row upon row of people until we mounted the platform where the principal was standing. She took my certificate, then signed her name to acknowledge that she had also been given my certificate of merit. The principal read out the marks I had received in each subject, and I heard a clatter in the hall that resembled applause. The principal held out her hand with a box wrapped in coloured paper and tied with a silken green ribbon. I tried to stretch out my arm, but it failed to move. Once more, I glimpsed Miss Iqbal approaching the principal. She took the package from her hand, then led me back through the rows of people to where I was sitting before. I sat down, put the certificate on my lap, and placed the box on top of it. The school year had come to an end. Fathers and guardians arrived to take the girls home. The principal sent a telegram to my uncle, and a few days later he arrived at the school to take me away. I had not seen Miss Iqbal since the night of the ceremony. That same night, when the lights-out bell rang, I was unable to sleep. I slipped down to the courtyard and sat there in the dark by myself. Each time I heard a sound coming from some distance away or felt some movement, I looked around me. At one moment I saw a shape, about the size of a person moving near the entrance. I leapt to my feet. My heart beat wildly and the blood rushed to my head. It seemed to me that the shape I had seen was moving towards me. I rose and walked to meet it slowly. As I advanced, I realized that my whole body was bathed in sweat, including the roots of my hair and the palms of my hands. I was alone in the darkness and a slight shiver of fear went through me. I called out, "Miss Iqbal?" But all I managed was a mere whisper that failed even to reach my ears. I could hear nothing and my fear increased, but still there was a shape the size of a human body looming in the dark. I spoke out in a loud voice which reached my ears clearly this time, "Who is there?" My own voice awakened me from what appeared to be a dream, like a person talking out loud in his sleep. The darkness seemed to lift slightly, revealing a low, unplastered brick wall about the height of an average person. It was a wall which I had seen before, yet for a brief moment I felt as though it had been built that instant. Before leaving school for the last time, I kept looking around me, sweeping walls, windows, doors with my eyes unceasingly, expecting something to open suddenly and reveal her eyes as they looked out at me for a moment, or her hand waving a usual farewell. I searched on frantically, without respite. At every moment I kept losing hope, only to regain it an instant later. My eyes shifted restlessly up and down, to and fro. My chest was heaving with a deep emotion. Before we passed through the outer gate, I gasped to my uncle, "Please wait for me just one more minute." The next instant I was following him into the street and the door had already closed behind us. But I continued to turn round and look back at it for quite a while, as if it was about to swing open again, or as though I had a feeling of certainty that someone was standing behind it and getting ready to push it open at any moment. I walked with heavy steps behind my uncle, carrying the image of that closed door engraved in my mind. When I ate my meals, or drank, or lay down to sleep, it was there in front of me. I knew that I was now back in my uncle's house. The woman who lived with him was his wife, and the children who ran around the house were their children. There was no place for me in this house except on the sofa, a small wooden couch placed in the dining room, close up against the thin wall which separated it from the bedroom. And so, every night, I could hear their subdued voices whispering on the other side of the partition.
"It's not easy to find work these days when all you have is a secondary school certificate."
"What can she do, then?"
"Nothing. These secondary schools don't teach them anything. I should have sent her to a commercial training school."
"It's no use talking of what you should have done. What are you going to do now?"
"She can stay with us until I find her a job."
"That could be for years. The house is small and life is expensive. She eats twice as much as any of our children."
"She helps you with the house and the children."
"We have the servant girl and I cook. We don't need her."
"But she can make the work easier for you by helping with the cooking."
"I don't like her cooking. You know, Your Holiness, cooking is the spirit you breathe into it. And I do not like what she breathes into her cooking, and neither do you. Don't you remember the okra she cooked for us? You told me it was not the okra you are accustomed to eat when I make it with my own hands."
"If you keep her instead of Sadeya, we'll save the girl's wages."
"She will not be able to replace Sadeya. Sadeya is light and quick and puts her heart into her work. In addition, she's not too fond of food or of sleeping long hours. But this girl's every movement is slow and heavy. She's cold-blooded and couldn't care less."
"So what do we do with her, then?"
"We can be rid of her by sending her to the university. There she can live in the quarters allocated to the girl students."
"To the university? To a place where she will be sitting side by side with men? A respected sheikh, a man of religion like myself, sending his niece off to mix in the company of men? Besides, where will the money come from for her lodgings and books and clothes? You know how high the cost of living is these days. Prices seem to have gone mad, and yet the salary of us government officials only rises by a few millimes."
"Your Holiness, I have a wonderful idea.
What is it?
My uncle, Sheikh Mahmoud, is a virtuous man. He has a big pension and no children, and he's been on his own since his wife died last year. If he marries Fardous, she will have a good life with him, and he can find in her an obedient wife who will serve him and relieve his loneliness. Fardous has grown, Your Holiness, and must be married. It is risky for her to continue without a husband. She's a good girl, but the world is full of bastards.
I agree with you, but Sheikh Mahmoud is much too old for her.
Who said he is old? He only went on pension this year, and Fardous herself is not that young. Girls of her age have already married years ago and born children. An old but reliable man is surely better than a young man who treats her in a humiliating way or beats her. You know how young men are these days.
I agree with you. But you must not forget the very obvious deformity he has on his face.
Deformity? Who says it's a deformity? Besides, Your Holiness, as the saying goes, nothing shames a man but an empty pocket.
Suppose Fardous refuses him.
Why should she refuse him? This is her best chance to get married. Do not forget what a nose she has. It's big and ugly like a tin mug. Besides, she has inherited nothing and has no income of her own. We will never find a better husband for her than Sheikh Mahmoud.
Do you think Sheikh Mahmoud will welcome the idea?
If I speak to him, I am sure he will agree. I intend to ask him for a big dowry.
How much?
£100, or perhaps even 200 if he has the money.
If he pays £100, then Allah will indeed have been generous to us, and I would not be so greedy as to ask for more.
I'll start with 200. You know, he's a man who can argue for hours over 5 millimes and kill himself over a piastre.
If he accepts to pay £100, that will be sufficient blessing from Allah. I will be able to pay my debts and buy some underwear, as well as a dress or two for Fardous. Oh, we cannot let her get married in the clothes she's wearing.
Anyhow, you won't have to worry about the bride's outfit or furniture or utensils. Sheikh Mahmoud's house has everything in it, and the furniture his late wife left behind is good, solid stuff, much better than the rubbish you get nowadays.
To be sure, what you say is the very truth.
I can swear by Allah, Your Holiness, that the Lord must really love this niece of yours, for she will be really fortunate if Sheikh Mahmoud agrees to marry her.
Do you think he will?
And why should he refuse, indeed? Through this marriage, he will become related to a respected sheikh, a man of religion. Is that not in itself reason enough for him to welcome such a proposal?
Maybe he's thinking of taking a woman from a wealthy family. You know how he worships the piastre.
And does Your Holiness consider himself a poor man? We are better off than a lot of people. Thanks be to Allah for everything.
Verily, we are full of gratitude to Allah for everything he has bestowed on us. May he be forever praised and exalted. And verily, our hearts are indeed full of thanks to Allah the Almighty.
As I lay there on the couch, I heard him kiss his hand twice in rapid succession as he repeated,
"Verily our hearts are indeed full of thanks to Allah the Almighty."
In my imagination, I could almost see him kiss the palm of his hand, then turn it over to imprint a second kiss on the back. Through the thin wall, the sucking sound of the two kisses reached me one after the other, and a moment later resumed as he moved his lips over to his wife's hand, or perhaps her arm or her leg, for I now began to hear her protesting,
"No, Your Holiness, no,"
as she pulled her arm or leg away from his embrace. His voice followed, muttering in a subdued, soft tone, almost like a short run of new kisses.
"Know what, you woman?"
The bed creaked under them, and now I could hear their breathing, irregular, panting, and her voice as she protested once again,
"No, Your Holiness, for the sake of the Prophet, no, this is sinful."
Then his stifled tones hissing back,
"You woman, you, what sin and what Prophet? I'm your husband and you're my wife."
The bed creaked even more loudly under the two heavy bodies locked in a struggle, alternately closing in on one another and separating in a continuous movement, slow and heavy at first, then gradually shifting to a strangely rapid, almost frenzied rhythm that shook the bed and the floor and the wall between us and even the sofa on which I was lying. I felt my body vibrate with the sofa. My breathing grew more rapid, so that after a while I also started to pant with the same strange frenzy. Then slowly, as their movement subsided, their respiration grew quiet again, and I gradually became calmer. My breathing resumed its normal slow regularity, and I dropped off to sleep with my body bathed in a pool of sweat. The following morning I made breakfast for my uncle. He raised his eyes to look at me whenever I brought him a glass or a cup of water, but each time I would turn my face in another direction to avoid his eyes. I waited until he left, then I kneeled under the wooden couch, pulled out my shoes, slipped my feet into them and put on my dress. I opened my small bag, folded my nightgown, packed it inside, and placed my secondary school certificate and my certificate of merit on top before closing it. My uncle's wife was in the kitchen cooking, and Sadeya, the servant girl, was feeding the children in their room. Hala, the youngest of my cousins, came in at that moment. Her black eyes opened wide, staring at my dress, shoes, and little bag. She had not learned to talk yet and could not pronounce the name Fardos, so she used to call me Dus. She was the only one of the children who smiled at me. And when I was alone in the room, she would come in and jump onto the couch and say, Dus, Dus. I would stroke her hair and answer, Yes, Hala. Dus, Dus, she would reply and giggle and then try to make me play with her. But her mother's voice would soon be heard calling to her from outside, so she would jump off the couch and toddle away on her little legs. Hala's eyes were shifting continuously from my shoes to my dress to my little bag and then back. She was holding on to the hem of my dress and kept saying, Dus, Dus. I whispered in her ear, I'm coming back, Hala. But she would not keep quiet. Her fingers held on to my hand and she continued to repeat, Dus, Dus. I gave her a picture of myself to keep her occupied, opened the door of the flat, stepped out and closed it silently behind me. I heard her calling out from behind the door, Dus, Dus. My feet ran down the stairs, but her voice continued to echo in my ears until I reached the bottom and walked out into the street. As I advanced over the pavement, I could still hear it coming from somewhere behind me. I turned round, but could see no one. I walked down the street just as I had done many times before. But this time it felt different, for I did not have any particular destination. In fact, I had no idea where my steps were leading me. When I looked at the streets, it was as though I was seeing them for the first time. A new world was opening up in front of my eyes, a world which for me had not existed before. Maybe it had always been there, always existed, but I had never seen it, never realized it had been there all the time. How was it that I had been blind to its existence all these years? Now it seemed as if a third eye had suddenly been slit open in my head. I could see crowds of people moving in an incessant flow through the streets, some walking on their legs, others riding in buses and cars. All of them were in a hurry, rushing along, oblivious of what was happening around them. No one noticed me as I stood there alone, and because they did not notice me, I was able to observe them well. There were people walking on the street who wore shabby, torn clothes and downtrodden shoes. Their faces were pale, their eyes dull, resigned, weighed down with a certain sadness and worry. But those who rode in cars had broad, fleshy shoulders, and their cheeks were full and rounded. From behind the glass windows they looked out with wary, doubting, stealthy eyes, eyes preparing to pounce and full of aggression, yet bordering on the strangely servile. I could not distinguish the faces or the eyes of those who rode in the buses, only their heads and their backs, which I could see crowded against each other, filling up the whole space of the bus, overflowing onto the steps and the roof. When the bus came to a stop at the station, or slowed down, I could glimpse the jaundiced faces shining with sweat and the bulging eyes expressing a certain fear. I was amazed by the huge number of people filling up the streets everywhere, but even more amazed to see the way they moved around like blind creatures that could neither see themselves nor anyone else. My amazement became even greater when I suddenly realized that I had become one of them. This realization filled me with a sensation that at first had something most pleasurable about it, but quickly changed like the wonderment of an infant that opens its eyes for the first time to perceive the world around, and yet the very next moment bursts out screaming, as it feels itself projected into a new environment where it had never been before. When night fell, I had not yet found a place where I could spend the long hours until morning. I felt something deep inside of me screaming with panic. I was now worn out with fatigue, my stomach racked with hunger. I rested my back against a wall and stood for a while looking around. I could see the wide expanse of streets stretched out before me like the sea. There I was, just a pebble which someone had tossed into its waters, rolling along with the crowds that rode in buses and cars, or walked the streets with unseeing eyes, incapable of noticing anything or anyone. Each minute, 1,000 eyes passed in front of me, but for them, I remained non-existent. In the dark, I suddenly perceived 2 eyes, or rather felt them, moving towards me very slowly, closer and closer. They dropped their gaze with slow intent down to my shoes, rested there for a moment, then gradually started to climb up my legs, to my thighs, my belly, my breasts, my neck, and finally came to a stop, fastening themselves steadily in my eyes with the same cold intent. A shudder passed through my body, like the fear of death, or like death itself. I tensed the muscles in my back and face to stay the shiver and overcome this feeling of terror which had swept my whole being. For after all, I was not confronted with a hand holding a knife or a razor, but only with 2 eyes, nothing but 2 eyes. I swallowed with an effort and thrust one leg forward. I was able to move my body a few steps away from the eyes, but I felt them on my back, boring through me from behind. I noticed a small shop lit up by a glaring light and hastened my pace towards it. I stepped inside and hid amidst the little crowd. A few moments later I came out and looked up and down the street cautiously. When I was sure the eyes had gone, I ran quickly down the pavement. Now I had but one thought in my mind: how to reach my uncle's house in the shortest possible time. Once back, I do not know how I put up with life in my uncle's house, nor do I remember how I became Sheikh Mahmoud's wife. All I know is that anything I would have to face in the world had become less frightening than the vision of those 2 eyes, which sent a cold shiver running through my spine whenever I remembered them. I had no idea what colour they were, green or black or something else, nor can I recall their shape, whether they were large, wide-open eyes or just 2 narrow slits. But whenever I walked in the street, whether by day or by night, I would look around me carefully, as though I expected the 2 eyes to rise up suddenly through some opening in the ground and confront me. The day came when I departed from my uncle's house and went to live with Sheikh Mahmoud. Now I slept on a comfortable bed instead of the wooden couch. But no sooner did I stretch out my body on it to rest from the fatigue of cooking and washing and cleaning the large house with its rooms full of furniture, than Sheikh Mahmoud would appear by my side. He was already over 60, whereas I had not yet turned 19. On his chin, below the lip, was a large swelling with a hole in the middle. Some days the hole would be dry, but on others it would turn into a rusty old tap, exuding drops red in colour like blood, or whitish yellow like pus. When the hole dried up, I let him kiss me. I could feel the swelling on my face and lips like a small purse or a water skin, full of a stagnant greasy fluid. But on days when it was not dry, I would turn my lips and face away to avoid the odour of dead dogs which emanated from it. At night, he would wind his legs and arms around me and let his old, gnarled hand travel all over my body like the claws of a starving man who has been deprived of real food for many years, wipe the bowl of food clean and leave not a single crumb behind. He lacked the ability to eat much. The swelling on his face interfered with the movement of his jaw, and his shriveled old man's stomach was upset by too much food. Although he could only eat small amounts, yet each time he would wipe his plate clean, sweeping the piece of bread held between his fingers round and round to make sure nothing was left. He kept looking at my plate while I ate, and if I left anything over, he picked it up, put it in his mouth, and after swallowing, quickly told me off for my wastefulness. Yet I was not given to wasting anything, and the only morsels I left on the plate were the scanty remains which stuck to its surface and could only be removed with soap and water. When his arms and legs let go of me, I would gently slip my body out from under him and go on tiptoe to the bathroom. There I would carefully wash my face and lips, my arms and thighs and every part of my body, taking care not to miss a single inch, going over it several times with soap and water. He had retired from his job, was without work and without friends. He never went out of the house or sat at a coffee house lest he be obliged to pay a few piastres for a cup of coffee. All day long he remained by my side in the house or in the kitchen, watching me as I cooked or washed. If I dropped the packet of soap powder and spilled a few grains on the floor, he would jump up from his chair and complain at me for being careless. And if I pressed a little more firmly than usual on the spoon as I took ghee out of the tin for cooking, he would scream out in anger and draw my attention to the fact that its contents were diminishing much more rapidly than they should. When the dustman came to empty the refuse from the bin, he would go through it carefully before putting it out on the landing. One day, he discovered some leftover scraps of food and started yelling at me so loudly that all the neighbours could hear. After this incident, he got into the habit of beating me, whether he had a reason for it or not. On one occasion he hit me all over with his shoe. My face and body became swollen and bruised, so I left the house and went to my uncle. But my uncle told me that all husbands beat their wives, and my uncle's wife added that her husband often beat her. I said my uncle was a respected sheikh, well-versed in the teachings of religion, and he, therefore, could not possibly be in the habit of beating his wife. She replied that it was precisely men well-versed in their religion who beat their wives. The precepts of religion permitted such punishment. A virtuous woman was not supposed to complain about her husband. Her duty was perfect obedience. I was at a loss what to answer. Before the servant girl had even started putting lunch on the table, my uncle took me back to my husband's house. When we arrived, he had already eaten his lunch alone. Night fell, but he did not ask me whether I was hungry. He had his dinner alone and in silence, without addressing a single word to me. Next morning, I prepared breakfast and he sat down on his chair to eat, but avoided looking at me. When I sat down at the table, he looked up and started to stare fixedly at my plate. I was terribly hungry and felt a crying need to eat something, come what may. I put my hand in the plate and raised it to my mouth with a morsel of food. But no sooner had I done this than he jumped up, shouting,
"Why did you come back from your uncle's house? Couldn't he bear to feed you for a few days? Now you will realise I'm the only person who can put up with you and who is prepared to feed you. Why do you shy away from me then? Why do you turn your face away from mine? Am I ugly? Do I smell? Why do you keep at a distance whenever I come near to you?"
He leapt on me like a mad dog. The hole in his swelling was oozing drops of foul-smelling pus. I did not turn my face or my nose away this time. I surrendered my face to his face and my body to his body, passively, without any resistance, without a movement, as though life had been drained out of it, like a piece of dead wood or old neglected furniture left to stand where it is, or a pair of shoes forgotten under a chair. One day he hit me with his heavy stick until the blood ran from my nose and ears. So I left, but this time I did not go to my uncle's house. I walked through the streets with swollen eyes and a bruised face, but no one paid any attention to me. People were rushing around in buses and in cars or on foot. It was as though they were blind, unable to see anything. The street was an endless expanse stretched out before my eyes like a sea. I was just a pebble thrown into it, battered by the waves, tossed here and there, rolling over and over to be abandoned somewhere on the shore. After some time, I was worn out by walking, so I sat down to rest on an empty chair that I suddenly came upon, placed upright on the pavement. A strong smell of coffee reached my nostrils. I realized my tongue was dry and that I was hungry. When the waiter boy came up to me and asked me what I would like to drink, I begged him to bring me a glass of water. He looked at me angrily and said that the coffee house was not for passers-by. He added that the Sayyida Zainab mausoleum was very close and that there I could find all the water I needed. I raised my eyes to look at him. He stared at me and then asked me what had caused all the bruises on my face. I tried to say something in reply, but the words would not come, so I hid my face in my hands and wept. He hesitated for a moment, then left me, and came back after a while carrying a glass of water. But when I put the glass to my lips, the water stuck in my throat as though I was choking and trickled back out of my mouth. After some time, the owner of the coffee house came over to where I was sitting and asked me what my name was.
"Ferdows," I said.
Then he added,
"What are all the bruises on your face? Has somebody hit you?"
Once more I tried to explain, but my voice choked again. I was breathing with difficulty and kept swallowing my tears. He said,
"Stay here and rest for a while. I will bring you a cup of hot tea. Are you hungry?"
All the time I kept my eyes fixed on the ground and did not raise them to look at his face even once. His voice was low, with a slight hoarseness which reminded me of my father. After he had eaten his meal and beaten my mother and calmed down, he would ask me,
"Are you hungry?"
For the first time in my life, I suddenly felt my father had been a good man, that I missed him, and deep down inside had loved him without really knowing it. I heard the man say,
"Is your father alive?"
I answered, "No, he's dead," and for the first time wept at the thought that he had died. The man patted my shoulder and said,
"Everyone has to die, Ferdows,"
and added,
"What about your mother? Is she alive?"
"No," I replied. He insisted,
"Haven't you got any family, a brother or an uncle of some sort?"
I shook my head, repeating, "No." Then quickly opened my small bag, adding, "I have a secondary school certificate. Maybe I can find a job with my secondary or with my primary school certificate. But if necessary, I'm prepared to do anything, even the kind of work that requires no certificates." His name was Bayoumi. When I lifted my eyes and looked into his face, I felt no fear. His nose resembled that of my father. It was big and rounded, and he had the same dark complexion. His eyes were resigned and calm. They did not seem to me like the eyes of someone who would kill. His hands looked obedient, almost submissive, their movements quiet, relaxed. They did not impress me as the hands of someone who could be violent or cruel. He told me he lived in two rooms, and that I could stay in one of them until I found work. On the way to his house, he stopped in front of a fruit stall and said,
"Do you prefer oranges or tangerines?"
I tried to reply, but my voice failed me. No one had asked me before whether I preferred oranges or tangerines. My father never bought us fruit. My uncle and my husband used to buy it without asking me what I preferred. As a matter of fact, I myself had never thought whether I preferred oranges to tangerines or tangerines to oranges. I heard him ask me again,
"Do you like oranges or tangerines?"
"Tangerines," I answered. But after he'd bought them, I realized that I liked oranges better, but I was ashamed to say so because the tangerines were cheaper. Bayumi had a small two-room flat in a narrow lane. It overlooked the fish market. I used to sweep and clean the rooms, buy fish from the market below us, or a rabbit or meat, and cook for him. He worked all day in the coffee house without eating, and when he came back at the end of the day, he would eat a heavy meal and then go to sleep in his room. I used to sleep in the other room, lying on the floor with a mattress under my body. The first time I went home with him, it was winter, and the night was cold. He said to me,
"You take the bed and I will sleep on the floor."
But I refused. I lay down on the floor and started to fall asleep. But he came over to me, took hold of my arm and took me to the bed. I moved by his side with bent head. I was so embarrassed that I stumbled several times. Never in my life had anyone put me first before himself. My father used to occupy the oven room in winter and leave me the coldest room in the house. My uncle had the bed to himself while I slept on the wooden couch. Later on, when I was married, my husband ate twice as much food as I did, yet his eyes never lifted themselves from my plate. I stood for a moment near the bed and murmured, "I cannot sleep on the bed." I heard him say,
"I will not let you sleep on the floor."
My head was still bent to the ground. He kept his hand clasped around my arm. I could see it was a big hand with long fingers like those of my uncle when he touched me, and now they were trembling in exactly the same way. And so I closed my eyes. I felt the sudden touch of him, like a dream remembered from the distant past, or some memory that began with life. My body pulsed with an obscure pleasure, or with a pain that was not really pain but pleasure, with a pleasure I had never known before, had lived in another life that was not my life, or in another body that was not my body. I ended up by sleeping in his bed throughout the winter and the following summer. He never raised a hand to strike me, and never looked at my plate while I was eating. When I cooked fish, I used to give it all to him and just take the head or the tail for myself. Or if it was rabbit I cooked, I gave him the whole rabbit and nibbled at the head. I always left the table without satisfying my hunger. On my way to market, my eyes would follow the schoolgirls as they walked through the streets, and I would remember that at one time I had been one of them and had obtained a secondary school certificate. And one day I stopped right in front of a group of schoolgirls and stood there facing them. They eyed me up and down with disdain, for there was a strong smell of fish arising from my clothes. I explained to them that I had been awarded a secondary school certificate. They started to make fun of me, and I heard one of them whisper into her friend's ear, "She must be mad. Can't you see she's talking to herself?" But I was not talking to myself. I was just telling them that I had a secondary school certificate. That night, when Bayumi came home, I said, "I have a secondary school certificate and I want to work."
"Every day the coffee house is crowded with youths who are out of work, and all of them have university degrees," he said.
"But I must work. I can't carry on like this." Without looking me in the face, he said,
"What do you mean, you can't carry on like this?"
I cannot continue to live in your house," I stammered. "I am a woman, and you're a man, and people are talking. Besides, you promised I'd stay only until you found me a job." He retorted angrily,
"What can I do? Get the heavens to intervene for you."
"You're busy all day in the coffee house, and you haven't even tried to find me a job. I'm going out now to look for one." I was speaking in low tones and my eyes were fixed on the ground, but he jumped up and slapped me on the face, saying,
"How dare you raise your voice when you're speaking to me, you street walker, you low woman."
His hand was big and strong, and it was the heaviest slap I had ever received on my face. My head swayed first to one side then to the other. The walls and the floor seemed to shift violently. I held my head in my hands until they grew still again. Then I looked upwards, and our eyes met. It was as though I was seeing the eyes that now confronted me for the first time. Two jet-black surfaces that stared into my eyes travelled with an infinitely slow movement over my face and my neck, and then dropped downwards gradually over my breast and my belly, to settle somewhere just below it, between my thighs. A cold shiver like the shiver of death went through my body, and my hands dropped instinctively to cover the part on which his gaze was fixed. But his big, strong hands moved quickly to jerk them away. The next moment, he hit me with his fist in the belly so hard that I lost consciousness immediately. He took to locking me in the flat before going out. I now slept on the floor in the other room. He would come back in the middle of the night, pull the cover away from me, slap my face, and then bear down on me with all his weight. I kept my eyes closed and abandoned my body. It lay there under him without movement, emptied of all desire or pleasure or even pain, feeling nothing. A dead body with no life in it at all, like a piece of wood or an empty sock or a shoe. Then one night his body seemed heavier than before, and his breath smelt different, so I opened my eyes. The face above me was not Bayumi's. "Who are you?" I said.
"Bayumi,"
he answered. I insisted, "You are not Bayumi. Who are you?"
"What difference does it make? Bayumi and I are one."
Then he asked,
"Do you feel pleasure?"
"What did you say?" I inquired.
"Do you feel pleasure?"
he repeated. I was afraid to say I felt nothing, so I closed my eyes once more and said, "Yes." He sank his teeth into the flesh of my shoulder and bit me several times in the breast and then over my belly. While he was biting me, he kept on repeating,
"Slut, bitch."
Then he started insulting my mother in words I was not able to follow. Later on, when I tried to pronounce them, I was not able. But after that night, I heard them often from Bayumi and from Bayumi's friends, so I got used to their sound and learnt to use them occasionally myself when I tried to open the door and found it locked. I would hammer on it and scream, "Bayumi, you son of a—" almost on the point of insulting his mother in the same way, but I held back the words on the tip of my tongue, realizing that this would be wrong. So I resorted to insulting his father instead of his mother. One day a neighbor saw me through the lattice of the door as I stood there weeping. She asked me what was wrong, so I told her. She started crying with me and suggested that we call the police. But the word police frightened me. Instead, I asked her to bring a carpenter. After a while, he came and forced the door open. I ran out of Bayumi's house into the street, for the street had become the only safe place in which I could seek refuge and into which I could escape with my whole being. As I ran, I looked back over my shoulder now and again to make sure that Bayumi was not following me. And every time I found that his face was not visible anywhere, I leapt forwards as fast as I could run. At the end of the day, I found myself walking down a street without knowing where I was. It was a clean, paved thoroughfare, which ran along one bank of the Nile, with tall trees on either side. The houses were surrounded by fences and gardens. The air which entered my lungs was pure and free of dust. I saw a stone bench facing the river. I sat down on it and lifted my face to the refreshing breeze. I had barely closed my eyes in rest when I heard a woman's voice asking,
"What's your name?"
I opened my eyes to find a woman seated next to me. She was wearing a green shawl, and her eyes were shadowed with green makeup. The black pupils in the center of her eyes seemed to have turned green, a powerful dark green, like the trees on the bank of the Nile. The waters of the river reflected the green of the trees and flowed by as green as her eyes. The sky over our heads was as blue as the bluest sky, but the colors mingled, and everything around radiated this liquid green light which surrounded me, enveloped me completely, so that I felt myself gradually drowning in it. It was strange, this sensation of drowning in a dark green with a density of its own, a consistency of its own, like the feel of water in the sea, a sea in which I was sleeping and dreaming, in which I was sinking as I slept and dreamt, in which I was gradually sinking without getting wet, gradually dropping without getting drowned. I felt myself lying on its bed at one moment, swallowed deep down inside, and a moment later carried gently upwards, floating higher and higher back to its surface, without moving an arm or a leg. I felt my eyelids getting heavier as if I were about to fall asleep, but her voice echoed in my ears again. It was a smooth voice, its depths so soft that it sounded almost drowsy. It said,
"You are tired."
I forced up my eyelids with an effort and said, "Yes." The green in her eyes grew even more intense.
"What did the son of a dog do to you?"
she asked. I gave a start like someone who has suddenly been awakened from sleep. "Who do you mean?" I asked. She wrapped the shawl around her shoulders more closely, yawned, and continued in the same soft, drowsy voice.
"Any one of them. It doesn't make a difference. They're all the same, all sons of dogs, running around under various names. Mahmoud, Hassanain, Fawzi, Sabri, Ibrahim, Awadain, Bayoumi."
I interrupted her with a gasp. "Bayoumi?" She laughed out loud. I glimpsed her small, white, pointed teeth with a gold tooth right in the middle.
"I know them all." "Which of them started it? Your father, your brother, one of your uncles?"
This time my body gave a violent start which almost lifted it off the stone bench. "My uncle," I replied in a low voice. She laughed again and tossed the green shawl backwards over one shoulder.
"And what did Bayoumi do to you?"
She was silent for a moment and then added,
"You haven't told me your name. What's your name?"
"Ferdows. And you, who are you?" I asked. She stiffened her back and neck with a movement full of a strange pride.
"I am Sharifa Salah ed-Din. Everyone knows me."
On the way to her apartment, I talked all the time, describing the things that had happened to me. We left the road which ran along the river and turned off into a small side street, and after a little while halted in front of a large apartment building. I trembled as I felt myself carried upwards by the lift. She took a key out of her bag, and the next moment I stepped into a spotless apartment with carpeted floors and a spacious terrace overlooking the Nile. She took me to the bathroom, showed me how to turn the hot and cold water taps on and off so I could have a bath, and gave me some of her clothes. They were soft clothes, with a lovely smell of perfume, and her fingers too were soft as she combed my hair and arranged the collar of my dress around the neck. Everything around me had this smooth, soft quality about it. I closed my eyes and abandoned myself to the softness of things. I felt my body was now like that of a newborn baby, soft and smooth like everything else in the flat. When I opened my eyes and looked into the mirror, I realized that now I was being born again with a new body, smooth and tender as a rose petal. My clothes were no longer rough and dirty, but soft and clean. The house shone with cleanliness. Even the air was clean. I breathed deeply to fill my lungs with this pure air. I turned around and saw her. She was standing close by watching me, her eyes radiating a strong green light, the colour of the trees and the sky and the waters of the Nile. I abandoned myself to her eyes and put my arms around her, whispering, "Who are you?" And she replied,
"Your mother."
"My mother died many years ago."
"Then your sister?"
"I have neither sister nor brother. They all died when they were small, like chicks."
"Everybody has to die, Ferdows. I will die and you will die. The important thing is how to live until you die."
"How is it possible to live? Life is so hard."
"You must be harder than life, Ferdows. Life is very hard. The only people who really live are those who are harder than life itself."
"But you are not hard, Sharifa. How do you manage to live?"
"I am hard, terribly hard, Ferdows."
"No, you are gentle and soft."
"My skin is soft, but my heart is cruel and my bite deadly."
"Like a snake?"
"Yes, exactly like a snake." "Life is a snake. They are the same, Ferdows. If the snake realizes you are not a snake, it will bite you.
and if life knows you have no sting, it will devour you.
I became a young novice in Sharifa's hands. She opened my eyes to life, to events in my past, in my childhood, which had remained hidden to my mind.